Thank you, Peter. One of the difficult things when there's a presentation and we don't know who we're talking to, it's like how much information to give, what amount of information. Some of it may be redundant, some of it may be too detailed. My plan is just to give a little overview of where Venezuela is at this point, and then we'll have a conversation. Some of the things I may raise may prompt some response, and that may be the best way to get at what I think are some of the larger issues. The first thing I would say is I think the events in Venezuela since 1998 are historic. I think they rise to the level of the Cuban Revolution. It's been 20 years since Chavez was elected, 20 years. And it's surprising to me that most people, I guess there's no way to measure that, large number of people don't know about the Venezuelan Revolution. If you read the New York Times or if you read anything outside of some left website, you probably will not know what's happened in Venezuela. It even troubles me when I have been at organizations of the progressive left or the liberal left that there's more of a criticism of Venezuela than there is any identification with Venezuela. And I think that's largely because of ignorance. I don't think it's necessarily malicious, but despite the fact that we say we know the New York Times, I mean, it's easy to castigate Fox News. Oh, that's that. But if you look at the New York Times, or if you look at CNN or Rachel Maddow, or even if you look at Democracy Now!, you're getting a distorted picture of what's happening in the world. Each of those may have factual truths, but each one is only part of a window that you can look at, and you don't know the larger scenario. Venezuela has made historic strides. Venezuela has suggested what is possible with a different way, not a third way between the right and the left, and we try to find a nice third path down the middle. But since 2006, when Chavez declared this is a socialist revolution, the Bolivarian Revolution is 21st century socialism. Well, what does that mean? It's just a nice big word. I mean, millennials now, the majority of millennials in the United States like socialism more than they like capitalism. But what the hell does that mean? They like Bernie Sanders. He's no socialist. So if you think that's what socialism is, and you think Sweden is socialist, well, then Venezuela is kind of like that. Not even close. And it was clear almost from the beginning, if we were paying attention. The very first act that Chavez took was to call for a constituent assembly. Not like in the U.S. where they're debating around whether the Supreme Court justice is going to live by a document that was written 200 years ago and literally translate what a bunch of white guys that owned slaves thought should be the law, and that's how American democracy is supposed to be. No, this was the citizens of Venezuela should write a constitution under which they live. And the debates were held in every little community all across the country, rural communities, factories, in Caracas. Every few blocks there would be debates about what should be in the Constitution. They debated this for months and months and months and months. Then they voted on it, and that became the Constitution. That's what my understanding of democracy is. We decide what we're going to do. We decide how we're going to live. Not somebody that died 200 years ago, that owned slaves, and women couldn't vote, but what we decide. And from the beginning, without romanticizing the Venezuela Revolution, and I'm sure we will talk about criticisms or shortcomings, it's remarkable the change that began from the very beginning. And that's part of what I think I would like to talk about some today is the relationship between the government and the state. Not seeing the government as the state, but the government as the political part of the state. And what has been the role of the government in Venezuela for the last 20 years in relation to the larger capitalist state. It became crystal clear to Chavez who and the Bolivarian movement, MBR 200, I think it was, after the 2002 coup, which, again, the New York Times says, finally there's democracy now that they've removed Chavez and we can return to democracy. In other words, overthrow a democratically elected president, put him on an island somewhere, and we will restore democracy. And the first thing they did was shut down all the television stations. The second thing they did was say the Constitution isn't acceptable. The third thing they did was dismantle the National Assembly. And that was what the United States, the UK, Spain, Colombia, Brazil at the time all said, this is what democracy should look like. Well, what democracy looked like was what happened a day after the population learned that Chavez was gone. They took to the streets. Community radio says our president's been kidnapped. And people came down in the thousands and the hundreds of thousands and surrounded Miraflores, and all those little worms inside that were being funded by the United States were scared to death and they ran away. And that was the end. Chavez is back. But that's like, what do we do now? And from that moment on, the trajectory that I think you could have seen with the Constituent Assembly, that you saw in Cuba after the Cuban Revolution, but took a sharp turn after the U.S. tried to interfere with the Cuban Revolution, it's what happened in Venezuela. From 2004 on, there was more of a commitment by the government, Chavez and the government, and the Bolivarians, which eventually became the PSUV, the Socialist Party of Venezuela, a combination of several parties, was to establish popular control. Written into the Constitution is participation. Participation. The people will decide. The population will decide. At the moment, they did not confront the existing institutions. They did not confront the Ministry of Education, or the ministry that ran the media, nor the banks, nor Fideicomeras, the Chamber of Commerce. Instead, they established what they called parallel institutions, funded by money from oil. If you want a comparison, compare Nigeria to Venezuela. Similar populations, similar sources of wealth, and how do they use it? And also compare how the U.S. media reports on those two countries. The level of poverty, the level of abuse, the level of military activities, the level of violence, the level of education, the level of health care. Compare Nigeria to Venezuela. From 2004 on, missions were established. Missions in education, missions in health care, missions for food, missions for housing, missions for indigenous rights. What does missions mean? It didn't mean that the government set up some institution like Lyndon Baines Johnson's War on Poverty and then hire a bunch of people and it all gets shoved over here. It meant that in each community, the citizens organized those missions. The citizens organized the schools. The citizens organized the community media. The citizens organized the clinics and built the clinics and filmed, just like the cameras and the systems here, was not something that was given from the government, but it was something that was, the resources were provided, but the population had to institute those. Which is why support for Maduro and the Bolivarian Revolution remains so substantial. Because it isn't some codillo, a populace, like the New York Times would like to say. I have a lot of goods. I will be like Mayor Daley. Your son can be a garbage worker. Your daughter can be a police officer. I'll get you a job driving a bus. And it's all kind of doled out. No, this was different, where the population actually made the decisions. I took a group of students, 2005, 2006, something like that, to Venezuela as part of Purdue Northwest's study abroad. And we visited community media radio stations, including one in Petare, where they had never had anything like this. And they were proud they had a health center. And they built the rooms, they built the buildings, they laid the cement block, they painted the buildings to put the equipment in for their TV station. This was not something that came from the outside and there was a bureaucrat that you had to have permission to use it. This was the people that lived in that community arguing, sometimes endlessly, over what should be on the air, who should be able to rent, to check out the equipment, what the program should look like. But that's democracy in action. And it's not something that's easily to report on unless you're serious about reporting on it. Something else happened at that period, from 2003 to about 2012. Compared to the rest of Latin America, even compared to the United States, there was a dramatic change in employment, in income, in health care, in literacy, in access to the media. Poverty in 1997 in Venezuela was over 60%. By the middle of 2006, 2007, it was reduced to less than 25%. In other words, better than on the west side of Chicago. It's because they were using the resources of the country for the benefit of the population. There's several things that I think characterize the Bolivarian Revolution. First, I would say, is international solidarity. That's the first thing. If you're looking to curry favor with the United States, you don't get, you don't go to the UN, you don't release documents, you don't hold press conferences and demand that Israel stops killing Palestinians. That's not one way to curry favor with the United States. You don't criticize the US for sending a missile into Syria. Most of Europe said, way to go, Mr. Trump. That's what the Democrats said. Finally, a president that we need, right? They all come together on that. Not the way that Venezuela proceeded. Not the way they proceeded when they set up ALBA or they set up UNASUR, they set up a Bank of the South, they set up trade relations with Bolivia, Cuba, Argentina, even Ecuador, Peru, Suriname, some of the smaller countries in the Caribbean where oil and resources were provided at cost, where the trade relations were not one of, can we have a balance of trade? Do we have to have a tariff? Do we have to raise taxes? Do we have to stop the import of goods? No, it was, this population needs this. If we can provide this within this collective group of, in the case of ALBA, I think it was 9 nations. In the case of UNASUR, I think there were 13 nations at one point. So that meant that Cuba sent doctors to Venezuela and provided free eye surgery to anybody that needed it. And Venezuela provided oil to Cuba for their energy, with nobody keeping a balance sheet over who's going to come out ahead, profit or loss. I mean, a balance sheet was kept, but it was not for profit or loss. I would note that with some of the changes of what for a while was called the Pink Tide, because for a while, following Chavez and following Lula, there was the election of Morales in Bolivia, there was election of Correa in Ecuador, there was Lula, Uruguay, Paraguay, even to some extent the Kirchner and what was the woman's name in Chile was a social democrat. It was appearing, and you would call it pink because it wasn't red like communism, but it was kind of moving in that direction. It's interesting with the coups that have been fomented, both legal and illegal, that pink tide has been pushed back, at least with the governments. So many of the countries that were part of UNASUR have left and they've formed their own group, which is largely supported and financed by the US, the Lima group that criticizes Venezuela for its lack of human rights. The other thing that strikes me, and again, it would be hard to find another country that rises to this level. There's been 25 elections, at least, national elections, Venezuela. 23 of those elections, the Bolivarian Party in one form or another, the Bolivarian Movement in one form or another, won those elections. There were only 2 that weren't won. One, when Chavez tried to get some enabling laws and extend his power, was defeated, narrowly defeated. And the other was the National Assembly elections a few years ago. But it turns out that 3 of the people that were elected were, there was some question of fraud and legality, and so the National Assembly was said to be not a representative body by the Supreme Court. The most recent election, 2018, this May, Maduro won, who is not a charismatic person, right? He's not a speaker that can talk for 3 hours like Chavez. He's not somebody that can woo the people in the neighborhoods, but he's a solid leader. Got 67% of the vote. 6 million some people voted for him in an open and fair election. In fact, the observers that go have said that some of the fairest elections they have ever seen, ever, occur in Venezuela, both with transparency and opportunity to run and the different political parties. Compare that to Honduras, El Salvador, Mexico, Colombia. You're a candidate, you may be shot because you shouldn't be running. You're a journalist that covers the candidate, you may be shot or imprisoned because it shouldn't be covered. You will not find that in the Chicago Tribune or in the Washington Post. You will find hand-wringing about Venezuela, but you won't find the same level. If I had a chart, I could hold up a chart. Here's the number of journalists killed in Venezuela. Here's the number of journalists killed in Mexico, in El Salvador, in Honduras. What happened when there was a democratic election in Honduras? Allies of the United States picked him up, put him on an airplane, flew him to Costa Rica, said we no longer recognize him, and what we're going to do is we're going to have a democratic election. And right away Obama and Clinton says, yes, we've restored democracy. By what? Removing the democratically elected president. 25 elections, 23 of them have been won. And what is the response of those in Venezuela that don't like the outcome? We have violence. We have guarimbas, right? You have wires strung across the street that decapitated a guy on a little motorcycle because you can't see the wire. You have people burning buses. You have people burning the health clinics. Where do they come from? They come in the gated communities on the east side of Caracas, where the wealthy live, who are making a lot of money off of the oil before the money from the oil was said, we're going to use it for the general population. They don't like it. The violence comes from the students that used to have exclusive access to higher education, but now there's Bolivarian universities, and if you're qualified, you can go, and you don't pay for your education. You don't end up in debt like our college students. You don't have to have a fortune like the college students in the private universities in Venezuela. And they didn't like their privilege being challenged. So the question for me is, how do we make sense of what happened in Venezuela in the last 20 years? I see it as a historic change. Parallel institutions with these missions, with the Constitution, with the nationalization of private industry that was aluminum, steel, oil, concrete, telecommunications, and more importantly is the people that work at those places get to make those decisions. We call it political economy. How is the political economy of a society or any particular institution run? And if I had a visual, but if you imagine a triangle, there's three parts of that that will tell you how that country or how that university or how that radio station works. The first part of the triangle, I don't care which part you start on, is who owns it, who controls it, who decides. The second part is the production values, which are directly related to who owns it, who controls it. And then the third part is, what's its social function? What is its relationship to that community or to that society? You ask those questions, you will begin to understand how any company, any country, any media works. And you will quickly realize we don't have a media of democracy in the United States because it's privately owned. And I work there as a journalist. I don't decide what the story's going to be. I don't even decide what story I can write. And what's its function? Is to make money for the people that own it and to spread the ideology of the people make money because they own it. Now you change that a little bit. You can change it off track. Christian Broadcast Network. Who owns that? Focus on the Family. It's a group of Christian churches. How do they make their decisions? Who decides what goes on the air? The people that own it. So that you call in to talk, they'll tell you to find Jesus, and then you'll get along better with your husband, right? Tell you to find Jesus, and you'll know what to do with your pregnancy. Tell you to find Jesus, and you won't listen to that terrible music. That's what they do. And what's its social function? On a good day, you could say, well, they want to save your soul and you live happily ever after. On a bad day, you say they want to sell you books and they want to recruit you to the church, and then you'll make tithes and you'll have a crystal cathedral like that guy down in Texas, right? So that's how it works. So what happens when you change the political economy of the media, which has been done in Venezuela for community media and public media? Who owns it? Well, the general population owns it, kind of like the Iroquois owned the land. Nobody owned it per se, but you can broadcast. In fact, it's in the Constitution. It has been changed. They have laws guaranteeing the right not just to hear the radio or to watch TV or to stop censorship, but to make your own. How many people in here have made a radio program in your life? Two. How many people here have written a novel? How many people here have performed music to a large audience? How many people here have made a TV show or a movie? But we talk about us being an entertainment-rich society. No, we aren't. We're a bunch of spectators. We turn the dial till something triggers our interest. That's not humanity. That's a political economy of private media. They decide. and they try to tap into a particular passion or some interest that we may have. So in Chicago, you've got 15 different radio types: hip-hop, country, talk, sport. It all belongs to the same company. We don't decide. The law in Venezuela says, you decide. You broadcast. You go to Katia TV, which was on the air long before Chavez showed up, but now it's on the air with sanction and with resources. A group like this, we would say, what would be a good story for us to do? Five of you over here could say, we'd like to do a story on the Little League in Lincoln Park. You might want to do a story on the history of Jews in this neighborhood. You might want to do a story over what's the status of the $15 day. The only caveat was, before you check out this equipment, you need to know how to use it. But you decide what's going to be, and then you go make your show, and it goes on TV. There's no vetting that says, well, we don't think the audience will be big enough for that. We don't know if there will be advertisers for that. In fact, from Katia TV and from communal councils, all of which have videographer committees, their productions end up on Avila TV and end up on Vives TV, which broadcasts nationwide. In fact, some of the community radio stations, I work with a community radio station in Three Oaks, Michigan, 7 mile radius, 100 watts. You got to drive real slow so you can listen to it. Well, good stuff, right? And we decide. But that's 100 watts, right? El Negro Primero, Enero de 23, other radio stations, Radio Mineras, Afro TV. When they broadcast in Caracas, they can reach 3 million people. Now that's community radio, not here. And you don't have community radio in Chicago, because the way the law is written, community radio can't interfere with a commercial broadcaster because you might tap into their advertising dollars. So here's what we have. And then what happened? Was it true that Chavez overspent, or when Chavez dies, Maduro didn't know how to keep the books and suddenly the economy went bad and this shows socialism didn't work? No, what it shows is, on a world scale, is capitalism failed. On a world scale, capitalism has failed. And the only way that you don't recognize that is not paying attention. Right? Look at Greece. Look at Spain. Look at Nigeria. Look at Chicago. Yeah, look at Chicago. The average wage for workers is now lower than it was 30 years ago. The average income for the majority of population in the U.S. is a little over $300. Even with a two-family income, you're barely above the poverty level. But the GDP looks good. So what happened? Several things happened. One, Saudi Arabia, United States, and some other countries in OPEC says, we're going to produce a lot of oil. We're just going to keep churning it out, and the price of oil goes down. And if you're financing healthcare, food, housing, media, employment, with the resources from oil revenues, and oil revenues tank, you go from $135 a barrel to $35 a barrel, what goes? All of that goes. And then, on top of that, you have, there's no better word for it than sabotage or disruption, right? The retail, it's a capitalist country. The largest retail firms are private industry. The largest media firms are private commercial media firms. The largest suppliers of equipment and machines for the oil industry remain in private hands. None of those have been touched, which will get us to where what might be done. But so what happens? You lose election. You're getting millions of dollars every year from the United States to foment unrest. You can't come to an agreement on how we should run. You have Capriles that says, I'll do this, and you wear your little blue and yellow shirt, but it doesn't turn out well for you. And you're desperate. And so you finance a bunch of students to burn things in the street, and the retail giants like Polar and some of the others just say, well, we don't have enough food because the socialist economy isn't working and we can't make any money, and we don't have any toilet paper, sorry. We don't have any flour, sorry. All that meant was they left it in the warehouse. It just didn't deliver it. Of course there's a shortage if you don't put it on there. There's plenty of stuff up in East Caracas. They got their deliveries. That was never a problem. But the stores where the missions were did not get the deliveries. So you had sabotage, you had disruption, you had an attempt to play the third road, I would call it that, where you would try to make a deal with the private industry, you would try to make a deal with private, right? We will lower the price on all of these goods. And Colombia is involved at this point. You lower the price on all these goods. So I can buy a bottle of milk for 10 cents, which is way below market value. So I'll back up my pickup truck and I'll buy all the milk in the store and I will go across the border in Colombia and I will sell it for 50 cents. I'm going to make a killing. One of the ways that the black market works is you buy dollars or bolivars at one price and you sell them at another. You could buy airplane tickets at one price and sell them for another. The people that had resources were really taking advantage of that, I would say an ill-advised system, but that's, I don't make those decisions. So you have economic sabotage. You have a media campaign in Venezuela and internationally with Britain, with Spain, with Mexico, with Colombia, and certainly with the United States. You have violence with the Guarimbas. You have the political campaigns of disruption, again, that are largely financed by the United States and private industry in Venezuela. The number that's thrown around is $50 million has been spent by the United States government in Venezuela for political competition in the last 8 years. That's only tapping part of it, because that doesn't include the $20 million that comes from USAID. It doesn't include the tens of millions of dollars that comes through the Republican, Institute of Republican, I don't know what, IRI. And the Democrats have one too. And there's other groups. So we're talking 50, 60, 70 million dollars, millions of dollars to have organizing sessions, to have workshops, to have training, to create really fancy YouTubes that will be YouTube videos that will be shown in the United States. I went to a presentation like this at DePaul, and they had a number of Venezuelan students that were at DePaul from Venezuela. They obviously all lived in a certain area of Venezuela, and they all hated Chavez, and they all showed videos of how terrible things were in Venezuela. Really flashy, well-made videos. The final thing is intervention, direct intervention, like the coup. And again, let's put this in some perspective. Dale asked me if I was going to go back and talk about the history of Venezuela. No, but let's talk since 1998, the history of U.S. intervention. A couple coups in Haiti. Obama arrested Aristide, put him on a plane. Marines flew him to Africa. Obama.
Clinton.
Okay. I can't tell the difference. I'm sorry. I can't tell. 2009, Obama. Am I good? Yeah. Okay. 2002, the coup in Venezuela. 2010, the police coup, attempted a police coup in Ecuador. 2012, the assembly parliament in Paraguay impeached Lugo. They impeached Rousseff in Brazil. The list goes on.
Honduras.
Didn't I say Honduras? 2009, yeah. So I would say this is a historic opportunity, and the capitalist class in Venezuela and the capitalist class in Colombia and the United States and the rest of the world understands it's a historic challenge to the way they run the world. We need to understand it's a historic challenge to the way they run the world. Whatever criticism there might be, this is kind of a test tube. This is an opportunity to show what can be done, where the citizens, the working class, the indigenous, women, youth, Afro-Venezuelans, what can be done when they are given the opportunity to make those decisions, as opposed to what we might read in the most of the U.S. press, and what you might hear, I would say, I don't know if you are of different political persuasions here, it would be interesting to hear. I know some on the left want to spend most of their time criticizing Morales or Correa or Maduro now because they didn't do this or they didn't do that or it's bureaucratic. I said before that this is a capitalist state. It has a socialist-leaning government, but it is a capitalist state. I think that we are currently looking at two states in conflict in Venezuela. On the one hand, you have private industry, you have the banks and the financiers, you have the Chamber of Commerce, you have the corporate media, you have the bureaucracy that has instituted, kind of implicated itself into even the government institutions. On the other side, you have workers' councils, you have militias. Just this past week, Maduro said that they're going to establish more militias, raise the number to 500,000 armed and trained Venezuelans to supplement the army. And every communal council, there's 50,000 communal councils. Every communal council will have a representative to the militias, including it's like a National Guard that actually would go to Ferguson and arrest the city council. That's what that National Guard would do. So we have community media, we have public media, we have all of these social missions. So you have these two institutions that represent different social relations. They're existing at the same time, in the same space. That cannot go on. It cannot go on. There is no third compromise. The Pope can't come in and say, bless you all my children and we'll all work. It's not going to happen. You make a deal over here with the devil, like, what did he say? I smelled the devil in the UN. You can smell the devil in East Caracas. You can smell the devil at the Chamber of Commerce. You can smell the devil at Venevisión. You can't make a compromise with that. Now, granted, I understand there's a difficulty. Cuba shows that, right? When Standard Oil says, we're not going to refine your oil anymore, and Castro says, okay, we'll refine it ourselves, and suddenly all hell breaks loose. Venezuela makes a decision like that, says we will nationalize the banks, we will control our currency. That, right? I mean, I could see in Maracaibo that a little Colombian thing comes over to rescue the poor students that are surrounded by crazy Chavistas, and they establish a rump government, and the United States recognize it, and now you have I don't want to give anybody any ideas, but if I was there, that's what I'd say. I mean, it's like, right? It's the oil-rich place. It's one of the few places that MUD had any kind of social appeal to the outside their own social, the elite and the capitalist class. They're really close to Colombia. They got a nice bay. They got good media there. I mean, it's long ways away from where the center of the rest of the population is. It's almost made for it. So my point is that there are two states in conflict, and the question is what to do. We don't tell Venezuela what to do, but I think we have a historic opportunity, a historic responsibility to defend that revolution. Not just because you should defend any country against U.S. intervention. You should defend Assad against the U.S. intervention. Dictator kills his people. The U.S. should not intervene. Nothing good will come from U.S. intervention. You should defend Ho Chi Minh from U.S. intervention. You pick somebody, I don't care how bad, the devil, I was talking about the devil, right? The U.S. should not invade hell, okay? I would defend hell against the U.S. invasion because it would get worse. So for that level, you should say the U.S. should not have anything to do with Venezuela. But there's another reason, because the things that have transpired show the way forward. And where they have stumbled has been because they have not been able to go forward freely. They've been faced with an obstacle course. But the idea that the people that work in a factory should decide what's produced, how it's produced, how long we should work, and what we should do with the wealth, what the hell's wrong with that? Right? I was in the UAW for a short period of time. They used to have a thing, 30 hours work for 40 hours pay. Right? We're going to go to work for... I was in the steel industry when there was 35,000 people working in Gary. I was a steel worker. You know they make the same amount of steel now that they did then, but they do it with about 7,000 people. Why couldn't we make the same amount of steel that we did then and all those 35,000 people work 20 hours a week for the same pay? Now, who wouldn't like that? Seriously, who wouldn't like that? Who? The people that own U.S. Steel. But I don't give a damn about them owning U.S. Steel. Keep all the money you have, Koch brothers. You're just not going to make any more. And now we will see what happens. And just like in this room, if we had a big conversation over what cake we should make, we'd have a big argument, how much sugar, how much, right? But still, we would be making that decision. Venezuela has been doing that on things like healthcare, nutrition, housing, who gets to fish in the Caribbean Sea, the culture. What should Afro-Venezuelan culture look like? What rights do they have? The media, who should run the media? They've been doing that. And any criticism you have is probably accurate. But so what? Get out of the way, let them do it. We have a responsibility to say, no U.S. intervention, U.S. hands off. And the problem is there are so many things happening that can take our attention, we lose sight of this. And I would argue that this is significantly different. This is qualitatively different than anything else you could do now. It's qualitatively different than fighting for the 15-hour day. It's qualitatively different than opposing U.S. intervention in the Mideast. It's qualitatively different than fighting for abortion rights. The reason is this is an opportunity to affect the immediate future of the entire continent. Each of the things I just said, what are they doing with 1,000% inflation in Venezuela? What would we do here? We would be going crazy. You know what? Every week they raise the minimum wage. So the bank says we're going to raise it. And the government says, nope. Bank says we're going to do it. Nope. Bank says we're going to do it. Nope. Now, this is not obviously an optimum solution, but the point is it's giving us a suggestion on how do you deal with $15 an hour? How do you put 27,000 people back to work at Gary Works? That's why I say it's qualitatively different. It's not just another place where U.S. imperialism wants to extend its footprint. This is a place where U.S. imperialism, right, sprained its ankle. It's not there. It can't be there. And because it wasn't there for a very short period of time, we got Bolivia, we got Ecuador, we got Uruguay, we almost got some others. But they're inching back. So don't think it's one of many, right? Stop using plastic bags. Good for you. I'm not going to use plastic straws. Good for you. Right? Stop U.S. intervention in Venezuela. It changes the course of history. There are very few times in our lives where we get to affect the course of history. I've seen a few of those. I think participation by many of you in this room changed the course of history because we stopped U.S. intervention in Vietnam. That changed the course of history. Defending the Cuban Revolution changed the course of history. This is one of those moments, and I would argue it's incumbent on anybody that seriously wants to change the world that we have to do everything we can in this moment to defend not just U.S. out, but defend the gains of the Venezuelan Revolution, even as you might criticize, because they need space to decide. They need space to decide. I was talking with Robert before. One of the reasons he asked me here is I spoke at one of those anti-war demonstrations, that's what it was called, a couple hundred people marching down Michigan Avenue for a while. I'm not opposed to action. I understand action is absolutely essential. But at this moment, probably a primary ingredient to get an action is to have more education, more conversation, more speakers. Whenever a speaker shows up, I try to get them wherever they can. Whenever there's a panel to talk, I try to go. Everybody in this room should. You talk to your neighbors, you talk to your wherever. That's the part that has to be done. That's the part that has to be done. That's what happened with Vietnam. That's what happened with the Nicaraguan Revolution. That's what happened with the Equal Rights Amendment for Women. You get to the actions when you've got to the point where people understand. And we live in a communication-rich world that's filled with communication garbage. So there's a lot to overcome. We can't rely on that before. But there's no reason not to put out an 8.5 by 11 sheet on fact sheet on Venezuela. Put it on YouTube, I don't care, but put it on a piece of paper because then you hand it to somebody and you actually enter into a conversation with that person and it registers and they can take it home and put it on their refrigerator. They can't forget about it in Instagram or what. I remember seeing that. It's on my Pinterest, but I can't find it. There's 1,000 other things posted. We need to do more of that. We need to have debates. We need to debate. I mean, the beautiful thing when I was at DePaul is I got to debate the Venezuelan students, right? From the horse's mouth, I live there, I know there. Okay, well, what about this? Right? We need that. It has to be more, and it's not just one of many things to do. It really is, and I think that we can start to see that when you see the devastation of the wars that exist, the devastation of the environment, the hurricanes, the water in Flint. We really are at that point. I don't know who said it, Rosa Luxemburg or somebody, barbarism or socialism. There's no question. There's no question. Venezuela provides an opportunity to say, why does socialism work? Look. And anywhere it's not working, it's not because of socialism, but because somebody's interfering. It'd be like saying, I got a toddler, look, it's walking, and somebody's standing behind him, tripping him. No, he can't get up. Tripping him, can't get up. Right? Puts a little block, they can't get over. No, they can't walk. They're never going to walk. Yeah. Nope. This is the beginning, and it's an opportunity for us to intervene and affect the outcome of history. So. If anybody wants, I will give you my email. It's just artz@purdue.edu. You email me, and I'll email you the... I've got a couple PowerPoints of U.S. intervention in Latin America and the Venezuela Revolution. I will mail you those PowerPoints. EDU. Yeah. And I'll email you the PowerPoint, and I would encourage you to use it. I have no copyright. Give your talk with the PowerPoint. Yeah, I think there's always a threat of U.S. direct intervention. The thing is that the U.S. has learned since Vietnam you have to kind of create the conditions that will justify that intervention for the population. The sanctions have already begun. The sanctions were started under Obama, where they basically declared that Venezuela was a threat to U.S. security and peace. So that started before the recent elections. And I could envision several scenarios, but the scenario that's required is for there needs to be a political force within Venezuela that the United States intervenes either for humanitarian reasons or to support that democratic effort, as they did in Honduras, right? And there has been attempts. I don't know how serious they are because it's always difficult to make that judgment, but there were... machinations within the military, within certain sections, and there's been a reshuffling of the military in the last month. Some of the people were reassigned, but that's also what prompted this the increase in the formation and training of the popular militias. But the way I read it is the majority of the armed forces, Navy, Air Force, the rest are supportive of the Bolivarian Revolution. I think I mentioned to Dale earlier, it's one of the few armies, it may be the only army in Latin America that wasn't trained at the School of the Americas in Georgia. And that means that there was a place for Chavez to take place because they were having classes and they were debating what was their service to the army, not like you would learn in a training camp in Georgia, and not like Pinochet's army or the Colombian army, but it was different. So I don't know the social composition of the army, but I would say several things. You can create a scenario for U.S. intervention. There has to be a disruption. There has to be internal turmoil. There has to be economic crises. There has to be a particular triggering event. And then there has to be some short-term political cover, whatever that might be. We're going to save the students in Grenada, they said before they sent the Marines, right? We're going to arrest the drug lord in Panama. We're going to remove the man that uses chemical weapons in Syria, right? You create these humanitarian activity in Kosovo, right? I mean, in each case, so is it a threat? I think it's always a threat. Is it an immediate threat? I don't see those conditions that particular moment, but that doesn't mean that there aren't things happening that we are not aware of and something can trigger fairly quickly. In Bolivia, it transpired over a period of time. And La Sucre, the second capital where the wealthy live, they said they wanted kind of home rule like states' rights, and they tried to separate themselves out in terms of budgeting and taxes, and there was an effort by the United States to get the OAS to recognize that. They're in a much stronger position now with the OAS because some of the changes in OAS have made it more difficult, easier for there to be challenges to the Venezuela through the OAS. So there's spokespeople for that. but I don't see that we're on the verge of a direct U.S. intervention. I think we're on the cusp of direct U.S. intervention economically, politically, but not militarily.
What the threat is to the United States security from Venezuela, or what the threat is to the United States from Venezuela?
There's two ways to answer it, what the stated threat is and what the actual threat is. And I prefer to talk about what the actual threat is. It reminds me, Oxfam did work around Nicaragua a couple decades ago, and they actually published a little book, and it was called The Threat of a Good Example. I mean, 3 million people lived in Nicaragua. What do they have, coffee and cotton? Why would the U.S. care? And the argument from Oxfam was, is they cared because Nicaragua was, in a smaller version, in a kind of distorted version, doing what Venezuela has done much more robustly in terms of providing media to the population, in terms of nationalizing land and the agricultural workers getting to make some decisions, in terms of actually democratic elections not having a dictator. That threatened to spread to El Salvador. In fact, the FMLN in El Salvador was inspired by the Sandinistas. And so you could easily see, it's the old domino theory, right? Vietnam goes, then Laos goes, and the whole world goes. And so that's the threat that Venezuela poses. I mean, if I'm in the capitalist class, absolutely, Venezuela is a dire threat. I mean, if I live in Venezuela, even though I'm better off than I was before, you're threatening the relationship. It's like if you win a $15 an hour, hooray. You win $20 an hour, hooray. The boss still can say you're fired. Or can still say, come to work at 6 a.m. and if you don't, you're fired. Or can dock your wages. The relationship is the same. The particular terms of that haven't changed. Venezuela is changing the relationship, and that's the threat to the capitalist class in Venezuela. Obama saw that. The bankers in the United States saw that. Exxon saw that. Even though they're making money hand over fist, as the money goes up, they're paying royalties. They weren't paying the same royalties they were before. But it wasn't about the amount of money. It was that Venezuela said, now we are the majority holders. We will decide. You can make the same amount, but we decide. That was the threat. What's the stated threat? Well, the stated threat is that, I don't know, it's hard to keep track of the stated threat. For a while it was that they were spreading revolution to the rest of Latin America because that's the reason they got rid of the Honduran president, because he was friends and wanted to be part of ALBA and wanted to have relations with Venezuela and Cuba. And so it's kind of this contagion. If you let this stand, and it's a threat to humanity because people are suffering and dying and there's inflation and it's economic insecurity. But it has to be a very convoluted argument and a very kind of almost a harangue. And the only ways you can carry it is by having the stories that you can read continually in the Washington Post or New York Times or the New Yorker. Just complete distortions. It's like the picture they showed us of the kids separated from their parents with the at the border, right? They showed the kids in cages. They don't tell you that that's from the Obama administration, right? Because it doesn't fit the narrative that Voldemort is the problem, right? That's the problem. That's the narrative. So you create a narrative, but I don't think it carries weight, which is why I said we need the fact sheets all the time. Response, right? We talk about fake news, that's it. There's fake history. I mean, the best fake news is not Fox. The absolute, absolute best fake news is the New York Times. All the news that's fit to fake is what it should say on the top, right? Serious, because nothing is not true. But because it's not true, it has a ring of truth to it, but it's complete distortion. Are there hungry people in Venezuela? Yes. Are there hungry people in Chicago? Yes. Are there hungry people in Winnetka? Yes. But that would be a distortion of the... But I could report on that factually. I had a friend who was a reporter at the Chicago Tribune. He ended up at the Black Business Magazine. The Tribune, I wish I could remember George. I don't remember his last name. He was sent out to do a story on welfare fraud. He was a black reporter. And he came back and he had welfare fraud from a white woman in Bolingbrook. And he wrote the story. And his editor said, oh, you're just so damn clever. Right? You're just so damn clever. But what was the story, right? You're supposed to find this welfare queen, right? But the majority of people on welfare happen to be white. The majority of people that are black are not on welfare. But that was the story. And you could factually find evidence of that. So that's part of the way, Peter, that this is done. You can find those things to say that claim. But it's not the full story. It's just a frame to look through, one window to look through.
Venezuela's allies, who are the people, the countries that are violating the sanctions to help them?
It may be a particular moment, but I'm at the point where I don't like, it's called reifying. I don't want to reify any nation as if a nation ever does anything. Nations do not do a damn thing. The newspaper will even say the capital of a country does it. Washington did the, what? No, Washington, some politician, some, right? So when we talk about nations, we're actually talking about the governments. And I think we need to make this distinction. The government is not the state. The state and the government are not the nation. So governments are lining up in support of the sanctions. And there's reasons for that. It's because of the U.S. and the trade and the favorable terms that they hope to get from the U.S. So the countries that have been defending consistently Venezuela are Cuba, Bolivia, and up until the recent past, Ecuador. And in the not-too-recent past, you could have thrown Uruguay and to some extent Brazil and Argentina and a few others in there. But kind of this creeping coups of the South, the Rousseff replacement, the Lugo replacement, the election of Macri in Argentina, each of these things has moved that away. The Honduras coup, right, each of those. The current Venezuelan government will speak in defense of, a Salvadoran government will speak in defense of Venezuela. But on the world stage, it's fairly narrow. And the fact that Russia and China will trade with Venezuela is good for Venezuela. It probably doesn't. Because again, the way the American public believes that the Russians interfered in our elections and they're that's the democratic trope now. So it's like the credibility of Russia and China is not high right now. So the fact that they trade with Venezuela doesn't really gain political credibility. It economically it solves some immediate problems. But and I don't have a I'm not an economist, I'm not a financier, I don't have a solution. Mark Weisbrot writes for he writes on Latin America, he's an economist, and there's been things you can read on VenezuelaAnalysis.com. There's many suggestions on what needs to be done economically, and I don't know the details on what should be done. I would just say unless the government gets control of the banking industry, there will be no solution. But I'm sure they have debates at this all night, because as soon as they make that step, that could be a trigger for U.S. intervention. If not direct intervention, a raising of the threat level, right? You've taken away our money. You're coming to take away. But if you don't control that, you can't control inflation. You can't control production. You can't control trade. Unless you control trade, you can't control whether or not there's enough food on the shelves. If you leave it in the hands of some retail giant, that's what has to be done, I think. Then you'll see who the real allies are. And I don't... And it reminds me of Cyprus in Greece, right? You ask the Greek people, do you want to stay in the EU? Do you want to go, right? Do you want to protect your pensions? Do you want to protect your wages? And they said, yes. And immediately he said, we can't do that. He got scared. Historic moment, he got scared. There's no other way of saying it. Politically scared, maybe not personally, but politically. The Sandinistas did that. Many people don't know. 1978, the Sandinistas said, now is the time to retreat and do more propaganda. And the general population said no. In fact, it was largely led by women. They took up arms in Monimbo and they fought the National Guard. And the Sandinistas said, well, we better go defend the people because the people are in an uprising. But the Sandinistas had retreated because they didn't want to call the people to arms because they didn't want to have a bloodbath and they didn't know if they had the political power to do that, if that makes sense. But once they saw the people move, they came. Cyprus and Syriza in Greece said, are the people with us? The people said, yes, we're with you. But they had a long debate and said, we're not sure. Are we going to step there? That's basically where the PSUV is in Venezuela. Are the people with us? And even if the people are with us, can we weather the storm? But the longer you delay that, the stronger the capitalist class gets, the stronger the Colombians get, the more difficult it is, the weaker your own population gets, because confusion arises when you're no longer able to provide the opportunities and decisions that were there before.
Last year in the U.S. tried really hard to get forces for international intervention with all their propaganda around the humanitarian crisis in Venezuela.
I need to make one comment, because I think we need to keep history in mind. I know there's a concern for Trump, and I have almost no concern for Trump. I think people should look at history. The only thing that has changed history has been social movements. It has been, I would argue, it's been historically irrelevant who's been in the White House. There was one person on the Supreme Court that voted against Roe v. Wade. Do you know who that was? The only person that the most liberal Democrat, JFK, appointed to the Supreme Court. The liberal Democrat appointed the only person that voted against Roe v. Wade. Nixon was president when the war in Vietnam was ended. Nixon was president when open housing was passed. Nixon was president when we got the EPA. Carter was president, we didn't get a damn thing. The ERA was defeated. Lyndon Baines Johnson was president when the U.S. sent troops to and expanded the war in Vietnam. Obama's been president, deported more people than Trump has, dropped more drones than all the Bushes and Clintons and everybody else. He used to say, I'm good at killing people. Every Tuesday, he'd gather his people in the White House, and they'd decide who they were going to kill that week. It was a game. He was the liberal, right? That has not mattered. And again, I would argue one of the things that's done is the Democrats turn the attention of the population that the threat to the world is Trump. The threat to women's rights, to transgender rights, to the environment. No, it's not. The threat is that you're listening to the Democrats and not that they're out there doing what you should be doing. The NAACP is having a convention right now. Where? Somewhere. Where are they having it? Heard it today. And you know what they're doing? This is the year to vote against hate. They've got all of their youth campaigning to get people registered to vote. They should be getting them into Black Lives Matter, and they should be shutting down every freeway in every city in the country. You want to see civil rights? Did civil rights come? There was no black elected officials when civil rights was passed. There weren't any. 6 years later, you got 4,000 black elected officials, and all the civil rights movement just, boom, it collapsed. Did it matter when Margaret Thatcher was a woman? Did that help the English working class? Seriously. I mean, we're on the verge of having 51% of Congress being female. Will we be a more peaceful nation? I mean, Clinton giggled when they shot Gaddafi. She giggled. No, it's a complete, right? Again, I would argue Venezuela suggests what we do. It's not one of those parties by a different class. It's how we organize ourselves. So you're right. The U.S. does this, and they have tremendous power because of the governments that are in charge of these different nations. Last week, they had a vote, just seemed a standard vote. The U.N.'s policy for years has been to encourage women to breastfeed. The U.S. had a resolution to take that out, and they got countries to vote with it with the threat of losing aid. So some countries, that's what they're still going to do, but they're not going to publicly say that because of the threat. So when you're saying the U.S. is trying to turn it back, they're using these other countries through the OAS to try to put... They tried to do it at the U.N. last November, right? But the U.N., China and Russia boycotted the meeting when they were trying to say there was a crisis, humanitarian crisis. But yes, it's constant threat. So we have our work cut out for us. But the Venezuelans have done their job. There's plenty of things, right? People say, don't tell me anything depressing. My sons will say, I'm tired of hearing this. I don't want to know about how we got screwed here. Okay, I'm only going to talk to you about what's happened in Venezuela and Bolivia in the last 20 years. You want some excitement? You want some power? You want to wave a flag? Look what they did. Look what they did. 97% of the people can read and write. People can fish in the Caribbean without getting a license. Afro-Venezuelans have their own TV station. Woohoo! Right? There's lots of things we can be proud of. You want something so your friends are tired of hearing all your naysaying? Talk to them about what's happened in Venezuela. And then they'll say, why isn't it happening now? You say, well, all those depressing things you don't want to hear about, that's the reason why. But if you'd leave them alone, this is what we could have.
The significance of NATO in Colombia, do you see any changes in Latin America in general with the new president of Mexico?
I'm not familiar enough. I'm not sure what will happen. It certainly opens up some opportunities for more discussions. It raises some hope for the Mexican population. Maybe there will be more opportunities for social movements and the working class to do some things. But I don't know if the election per se. I think that's an open. That remains open. The question of NATO is in Colombia. Colombia's kind of got this little shining star, like they've been deputized by the U.S. for activity in Latin America. And I think if there's intervention in Venezuela, it will come from the Colombia border, essentially. It's easy to forget that in Colombia they shoot journalists, in Colombia they shoot people that run for office. In Colombia they have paramilitary death squads, in Colombia they have high unemployment, in Colombia they have, right? Because it's presented as, well, they just had this peace process. This is all wonderful and things are going to be going forward. But the U.S. military remains big in Colombia, and most of the aid that went for drugs was not used to eradicate drugs. It's one of the key allies in Latin America all along has been Colombia. Which, again, if you step back and ask, let's look at U.S. allies. Why Colombia? A big question. Sometime we should have Kim Sipes here and we can debate him, because I don't think there's such a thing as U.S. imperialism anymore, which is way off topic, because I think that the current stage of capitalism has become transnational, and the transnational capitalist class has forged alliances across national borders. And that's, you can see that economically. The largest corporations in the world are all transnational. Largest media in the world are all transnational. General Motors produces more cars in China than they do in the United States, right? You're going to run down to Caribou Coffee? That's not an American company. You're going to use Heinz ketchup. You're going to wear Ray-Ban glasses. You go to AMC theaters? None of those are American. American. They're transnational capitalists. So the problem that they have is there cannot be a transnational military. So you use a variety of militaries to do that. You use France in northern Africa. France went into Mali. You use Britain in the United States and other places. In Latin America, you could use Colombia. NATO is a cover for that collaboration, which is one of the reasons I also don't think that the capitalist class wants Trump. They want him to be gone. I mean, they like his tax thing and stuff, and they like when he bombs Syria, but they want him to be gone because they don't want protectionism. The largest capitalist institutions and companies in this country do not want protectionism. It's not in their interests. The problem is there's a contradiction. Stan mentioned neoliberalism. There's a contradiction, right? You're going to squeeze more out of the working class. You're going to take more of public resources. You're going to take more of public services. You're going to provide more to the wealthy, to the owners. And that means lots of people are unhappy. Well, you would hope that people would say, well, capitalism doesn't work. We want to go forward. But a large section of the population doesn't say capitalism doesn't work. They say, what's the problem here is immigration, or the problem is we're kowtowing to the cultural left, and we got to go back to the way it was in the 1950s. So while you have the growth of the left in France and Germany, you have the tremendous growth of the right-wing supernationalists, including in this country. That's a contradiction. But the transnational capitalists are happy with that. They can live with a little bit of nationalism here and there because it takes people's attention away from austerity, the living wage, the loss of social services. Right? Remember when the phone used to go dead in your house and when it finally worked, you would tell AT&T you wanted a credit for the day that they didn't give it to you, and they would give you a credit, and you would be disturbed if you lost. Right now, the phone, you drop the phone, you lose a phone call almost all the time. It's just par for the course. You just kind of accept it. You're paying four or five times as much for it, right? And you got to pay to go to school. You got to pay for your water. You got to pay for your water, right? And it just becomes a cultural norm. You have to enforce that, because if it isn't a cultural norm everywhere, you have to enforce that. You can sometimes rely upon that particular military, but you can't always. So you need NATOs. You need a NATO. Or you need some, what do they call it? Alliance of the Willing.
WTO.
Yeah. Well, yes. Economically, they've got the economically, the structures are there. The WTO, the IMF. Every industry has their own transnational organization. The media industry has their transnational groups of production and distribution, from television to movies to theaters to digital broadcasts. They have those. What they don't have is an enforcer. The WTO is the court, but what if the court, right, if you ignore the court? But even more, what do you do when there is a popular uprising? You have to have some way of intervening, and that intervention can't always be with the local forces. So yes, if they wanted to intervene in Venezuela, it would be politically easier for them to do it if it was NATO or the OAS, if the OAS had a force. It was easier when they sent the African forces into Somalia than it was some other UN forces. That is always true. But I think that's the only reason NATO's there, because you need a transnational military force.
In Bolivia, when the people refused to pay for the water, the army refused to shoot the population, and they drove Bechtel and U.S. finance out of the country.
Yes, good example.
Nixon was able to divide China and Russia in the 70s, and in the biggest achievement of Obama was able to force them to unite. And now, I think that's one of the reasons why one of the goals of Trump meeting in Helsinki will be to try to divide, separate Russia and China again. Duterte is one of the big threats on the national security of the U.S. because there's a trend within the nationalist government. So like in Indonesia or Malaysia, or that they're starting to question the role of the U.S. So these are...
I didn't stress enough in what I presented was the question of social class. When I talked about the problem I have with identifying a nation as a nation, or a government as a government, or even when we talk about the U.S. or the IMF or some others using a particular nation, I think we need to be able to take that analysis to what social class is in power. What does that government represent? Why is that government or nation supporting the U.S. in the OAS or in the UN or in some other scenario? It's because that government is representing the capitalist class of that particular nation, and they have the same interests as the capitalist class that might have its headquarters in New York City. If we don't do that, we get excited and we get our heads turned quite easily, right? I mean, there was a lot of illusions with Lula. But when you understand how he severed his connections with the Workers' Party and how he severed his connections with the landless workers, right, you begin to see, okay, Lula is, he's kind of like a Bernie. He'd be like if Bernie was president. Right? Everybody gets $15 an hour a day, but we're going to bomb Palestine. Really, that's what his policy is. It's right? Bernie's wants to get rid of the dictator in Venezuela. That's his stated position. So if we talk about China or Russia or Greece or another, who's running that country? That country is, that nation, that government does not represent the population. It represents a population that's in power. And that's the threat Venezuela poses, that's the threat Bolivia poses. There's a different population with political power, not economic power. You might argue economic power, probably the only place would be Cuba at this point. But again, the largest corporations in the world do not want the U.S. to be at odds with China or Russia. You buy a BMW, you're buying an American-made car. You buy a Honda, you're buying an Indiana-made car. You go to AMC theaters, you're going to give your money to a Chinese theater chain. You buy pork, you're buying it from a Chinese company. The largest pork producer in the U.S. belongs to a Chinese company. You buy a Lenovo laptop computer, you're buying a Chinese computer, right? You go to China and you buy yourself a little Wuling, you're buying a GM car. What's the nationality of that? It's silly. What social class owns that production and makes the wealth off it and decides what's going to be produced and how it's distributed? That's what matters. Now, if I'm running things, if I'm running the company, I'm completely happy to have the women that work here at odds with the men. When I was a steelworker over here in Cicero, the women would apply for a job to be a machine assembly helper, but they couldn't lift the reason was, well, sure, you can bid on the job, but you can't, you know, you do the test, you couldn't lift 150 pounds of solid steel. Well, neither could the men, but they would try, right? So what did, I was on the affirmative action committee for the union. What did we do? We said, well, you're right, you can't. Put in a crane. End of discussion. So they got all these little cranes. They weren't much bigger than that podium. Over every place in the... And unfortunately, this was good for the company because there were fewer men going out with bad backs because the men used the cranes too. But the point is, they didn't care about the divisions between men and women, except that they could use that to divide men and women to keep a certain wage, a certain division. We know that that's done with race in this country. Well, it's done internationally with nationalities. So if you can stir up hatred from the steelworkers or the Harley-Davidson people towards China, then you're not getting it stirred up against U.S. Steel. You're concerned about the tariff on steel? No, here's the problem. They laid off 27,000 people 20 years ago. That's the problem. But if we can turn, so that in that sense, stirring up that nationalism will carry you a little bit. But in the long run, that's not what the U.S. corporate machine, it's, in my mind, it's really hard to talk about a U.S. corporate group because there's very few. There are very few. And those would truly be maybe Coors beer. I don't know.
You talked about the contradictions in capital that are now internationalized. John Pilger's film, The Coming War in China, makes a strong case that within this country, there is a contingent of people. They may associate with the capitalist class, some may be a part of it, but there's an ideological mindset that sees China as a threat to U.S. power, financial and military. Can you speak a little bit to that, in as much as China's relationship with Venezuela is often pointed out as part of threat to the United States interests?
Well, I would just say when I talk about the capitalist class and trying to understand the social class that's in power in any particular nation and which class is running the government does not mean there are multiple classes in every society. So the capitalist class may be very small and may ultimately be in charge, but they don't make most of their decisions. That's why they hire CEOs and they have managers and others to make those decisions. And that's why there's political parties to make the political decisions. In that matrix, the people that are in the political parties and the people that are managers end up with their own social interests. And sometimes their social interests do not conform to the interests of the class that they represent, or they only conform in a partial manner. If I'm a Democratic or Republican representative, U.S. representative to Congress, I'm in a permanent campaign mode because every 2 years I have to run for office. And if that becomes my livelihood, that becomes my vocabulary, that becomes my culture, that's what I do. And I will try to fundraise and I will try to speak to the constituents that will get out the votes. And oftentimes I will not do what's best for the capitalist class that's there in the short term because I need to be elected. I often think of, was he a Sergeant Burge, the guy that tortured people in the...
John Burge,
in the, right? He had a way of being in the world, which was one of a torturer, a racist torturer. I would argue that was not what any mayor wanted. They want enforcement. They want to maintain control in the black community. They want to set examples. They want to use the prison system as a form of social control. But they don't want a mad dog to do this. They want it to be done right. But Burge wasn't operating with direct orders. He was operating in a system that would allow that because he had developed that. It's kind of like Oliver North, right? Developed in a certain military system where this was allowed. Or Lieutenant Kelly with My Lai at Vietnam. That's not what the officers want, but you develop a culture, and then there are individual interests that arise within that. So it's not unlikely that you will end up with a Rumsfeld or somebody else that thinks the U.S. should invade all these countries. But at the same time, you have a transnational section of the political class that understands a different trajectory of what needs to be done. Ultimately, that allows opportunities for the working class and small business people and citizens and youth to intervene in those openings. Which means you have to pay attention to it. I would say you don't want to get diverted by it, but pay attention to it because an opportunity may arise to oppose the war in Vietnam, to fight for a $15 an hour day, to respond to the bad water in Flint, Michigan, to talk about how this is a response of a disconnected political system and a racist character of how public services are provided. Absolutely. But I would expect that there will be sections of the political managerials of this society and other societies that will intervene for their own particular purposes that they actually believe, right? Like the people that believed in Brexit, or the people that think that the U.S. need to oppose China. But the large interests, the transnational capitalist interests, they're not going down that road. They will tolerate it, just like Burge was tolerated, but the larger system is what they're after. And at a certain point, they will hold that person up as somebody that should be weeded out, because that's not who we are. We need to weed this bad apple out, this bad teacher, this bad politician, right? I would say most people in Congress have something that they don't want known, but when they go astray too far politically, that will be known. Suddenly they will know about illegal contributions, sexual harassment, all of it. Somebody somewhere has a dossier on everybody, and if you vote the wrong way, you will be that will come out. But as I said, it's the opening of a big question about how to rule politically when there are multiple social interests, race, class, gender, multiple ones, which creates contradictions, which creates opportunities to intervene to change the course of history, which is kind of where we are. Opportunity to change that course.
Thank you, Lee.